We get started. Thank you, everybody, for coming. I'm Andy Kark, and I'm going to be moderating today. Thank you again for the Harry Baron Trust and Rabbi Zev Baron for the continued support of the Torah for Tycoons. Throughout the past 11 seasons, Nicole has brought the Torah perspective on business and personal ethics to over 500 people throughout this program. You'll take a moment to look at the back page of your booklets. You'll see the next month's T4T class scheduled for February 3rd. And the class will focus on organ donations and will be presented by Brand Cordfield and Rabbi Aaron Yehuda Schwab. Please let your friends and acquaintances and colleagues know about this. I'd like to also call your attention to our executive learning program. This program provides business people and professionals with the opportunity to bring Torah study into their day at their offices. If you'd like to incorporate Torah into your workday, please speak to us about bringing inspiration and Judaism to the workplace. Also, the Kolos Winter Gardens Women's Night Out will take place this Tuesday, January 12th. This is a unique event featuring best-selling author Deborah Fine and sensational, an indulgent experience for each of the five senses. For more information on costs and reservations, please speak to Mrs. Litzman or contact the Kolel at info@denverkolel.org. And if you've missed past Torah for Tycoons classes, you can get those recordings. You can find them on the Kolel's website at, again, denverkolel.org. You can also find the latest info on Kolel programming and archive classes on many topics on the website. So with that, I'd like to introduce our today's presenters, Mark Cooper, President of Cooper Development, and Rabbi Mordechai Fleischer, Senior Educator at the Denver Kolel.
First of all, I don't want to make any clone jokes, as we already make jokes amongst ourselves about whether I'm my own clone or not. My real copy is in Mexico, but it's much, much warmer. And I do have to disclose, I think as most people know here, I am not a scientist, a biologist. I'm not Cooper Development does not, we're not working in the cutting edge cloning technology. We're a real estate development company. But when I was asked to do this subject, I said, sure, I take Star Wars. I actually read a lot of science fiction as a hobby. So, and we all, pretty much have an idea of what a clone is. I mean, a clone could be something as simple as having a fruit tree and taking a branch off the fruit tree, grafting and getting it to grow roots, and then you've got the identical fruit tree again. It could also be up to now in the lab, we've all heard of Dolly, where a sheep has been cloned. There are a number of other animals that have been cloned. And officially, no humans have yet to be cloned, though we always wonder what goes on in North Korea, China, and wherever else. But so the general idea is cloning, you know, we're going to talk mostly about cloning humans, though we'll talk a little bit about cloning in general. Is this right to clone, you know, an animal or a plant or a person? But the idea in an animal or a human, generally the idea is you would take a sample of cells from somebody and somehow recreate those in a way where you can plant that into a womb, and you get a baby 9 months later, 10 months later. That's the exact copy of the person who donated the cells. There are some ideas too, like you maybe could clone a part of a person, maybe the liver. I don't think we're really talking about that today, about whether it's halakhically correct. We're going to touch on that. Yeah, sure, we'll touch on that too. Whether it's, if we could grow a heart in the lab and transplant the exact heart into a person, that's kind of interesting. Same thing too, if we really like our cow or our wine or our corn, is it okay to clone these species that are non-human? And then, as I was saying, now getting into the questions, cloning a human is going to happen, whether it's actually done or someone in a lab says, I can do it now. We know it's only a matter of time. So as its base, is it right to clone a human? Just like is it right to clone an animal or a plant? And then we start asking questions like, is it okay for, let's say, a sterile couple who can't reproduce themselves? Is it kosher for them to clone one of themselves or a relative, and then have a child that's their clone. Is there a difference if I'm not sure if you're going to touch on that? I did ask a question. Is there a difference if this clone is in the womb, we've talked about, but it can also be done in a machine. You know, in theory, we could create a cloning machine where we could raise baby, you know, raise the fetus in a machine, which maybe is a whole different class too.
Depends how much time we have.
Depends how much time we have, right? Now, there's a question too. Like, if we want to clone, if we can clone people, is it right to clone people just because we like their attributes? Do we want to clone Mr. Peyton Manning now that he's retiring? Do we want to clone a great rabbi? You know, can we get a little hair follicle there and recreate the person? You know, we could philosophically debate whether that person would even have the same personality or intellectual traits or upbringing. There's a lot of factors there. Now, big question is the clone a person? You know, is it a human being, this reproduction of someone who's lived or is living, is this a person? Is this a human? Does this clone have a soul? You know, what are we going to think about in the Torah? Is it going to have a soul? Does anyone own this clone? You know, can you possess a clone? And more importantly, what we would probably see people trying to clone other people is if you can clone the replica of yourself, maybe you can live 150 years. You harvest the organs from this clone, for example. You replace your liver and kidney over the years. Is that okay? So there's a lot of things that can happen in the future now with cloning, even beyond armies, you know, like the Star Wars again of clones, which I guess is a possibility as well. So I think those are enough questions to ask, and we'll turn it over to the rabbi. Yes.
Thank you very much, Mark. So as you saw just from Mark's long list of questions over here, this is a huge discussion. There are a lot of different facets and aspects to talk about and to examine, and I don't think we'll have time to examine everything, but I'd like to at least try to have a discussion together with Mark and with all of you about some of the basic issues, the basic issues that come to mind, and try to maybe flesh out a little bit about what some of the issues would be in terms of the cloning. Now, just a disclaimer on my part, and that is that normally when we have Torah for Tycoons, we're dealing with a question that is pertinent and relevant that has been dealt with by authorities. And here, we're dealing with issues which have not been dealt with on a practical level by the rabbinic authorities because it hasn't really happened yet. And although a lot of rabbis have spoken about some of the issues and problems that could come up from a Torah halachic aspect, I don't know that we can walk out of here with any definitive ruling at this point. There was a great rabbi by the name of the Chazon Ish. He was known by the name of his work, the Chazon Ish, Rabbi Avraham Yishai Karel. It's a very great rabbi. Passed away in the 1950s, lived in Israel. The city of Bnei Brak, those who are familiar today, is largely due to his influence. Very, very great rabbi. And someone once came to him with a complicated question, halachic question. And he was one of the preeminent halachic decisors of his time. And he said, is this a practical question? And the person said, no, I'm just in theory. He said, do you think I just shake these rulings out of my sleeve? It takes a lot of time and effort. And so, you know, when you have so many questions, especially with all the modern technology that comes up today in the world, so many questions that come up, you probably will not hear a definitive ruling until it becomes practical. And as Mark said, in the Western world, officially it hasn't happened yet. I don't know if that H-bomb that North Korea officially exploded yesterday, maybe they had some failed experiments there or something, I don't know. But one always wonders what's going on, you know, behind the curtains, even in America. But we don't have cloning happening, certainly not publicly at this point. So we could try to talk about the issues, and in theory, what some of the Torah issues that would come up would be. Right off the bat, the first thing that comes up is the oft-quoted line, you're playing God. Okay, the oft-quoted line that you are playing God. And really, if you look at source number one, there's a prohibition in the Torah of interbreeding species. Okay, be that plant life, be that animal life. You're not allowed to interbreed different species. There's an entire tractate in the Talmud devoted to defining what constitutes different species and what is permitted and what's forbidden. But there's a basic prohibition not to mix different species together. Even if they could interbreed, you're not allowed to. And the Ramban, Nachmanides, a great medieval halachic authority, he points out that one of the ideas behind not interbreeding is because, he says, one who interbreeds two species changes and weakens creation, as if one thinks that God did not complete his world as needed, and one desires to assist in the creation of the world and add new creations. That's his comment. Okay, so the Ramban has a comment where essentially he says, you should not be playing God by trying to improve the creation. Now, this passage, in of itself, it is a very, if you're familiar with a lot of the philosophy behind Judaism, one of the major philosophical underpinnings of a lot of what we do in the world is that God charges us to help him in perfecting the world. Okay, both spiritually and in many ways physically. And so, how do you resolve that idea with what the Ramban is telling us over here? I don't know that there's a very clear answer, but I think that one can understand that there's a line to be drawn somewhere. Where you draw that line, I'm not sure. But a line to be drawn between improving the world by taking wheat and making it more productive, making it more drought-resistant, and more pest-resistant, where you take God's creation and you improve it. Okay, really at the outset, God says to Adam after he eats from the tree, he says, by the sweat of your brow you shall eat bread, because we don't have loaves of bread growing on the tree in this world. We have to plow, plant, harvest. So there's an improvement of what God gave us right off the bat. But it's taking what God gave us and working with those materials to improve it. Whereas when you take things and you start playing around with it, you start doing stuff which is seems to be at odds, not so much improving, but making new things, and who knows what's going to come out of it, and who knows where it's going to lead, and interbreeding and creating all sorts of new species, that's where things get a little more dicey, and that ostensibly is what the Ramban is referring to. Okay, and I did see some comments, again, in theory, made by some great rabbis, that cloning potentially would not be within the spirit of the law of this prohibition against interbreeding. Because the idea is, God gave you a world, this is what you have to work with, why are you trying to come up with new ways to create humans? God put a very nice system in place, you have a male, a female, and they are able to produce a child. And that should be the method taken. Why do you have to come up with new ways that require artificial involvement by humankind to create new people? That would not be within the spirit of the law. Does everyone agree with that? I'm sure they don't. But that's just one angle to consider on the overarching subject of cloning. Okay, and that's just one idea in terms of where do you draw the line in terms of humanity playing God? Because to some degree we are supposed to play God and improve the world, but drawing the line and creating entirely new things that are not part of the normal, natural world we're familiar with is where things get a little more questionable. Having said that, let's assume that there are clones being created. Okay? Let's assume that sometime someone creates a clone. The question now becomes, as Mark said, what is the status of that clone? Is it a human? Can you create clones and then, well, I made you, so you're my slave, and enslave the clones? Another question that Mark raised, and I think you told me there was a movie about that where they were raising these teenagers to be a...
Yeah, I didn't write down the name of the movie. We could look it up afterwards, but a couple of years ago, my wife and I, we went to see a movie, and we weren't quite sure what we were getting into because it was, as
the
some
island.
Of you, what?
The island.
No, it was not the island.
Never Let Me Go.
Never Let Me Go, yes. Who said that, Saul? Yes. It Never Let Me Go. The movie starts out as what I would say, there's sort of it's a British movie. There's that British genre of boarding school, coming of age movies. I'm sure we could do some yeshiva sporting school coming-of-age movies too out there too, right? But so just as typical, like these young adults becoming adults and growing up and having maybe a mishap or adventure, but what they didn't tell you until about at least halfway through the film is that they were all clones who were passing their time at this boarding school, and they were being treated as people, and they were being educated, and they were making relationships with each other as friends and stuff. But they were on—they were clones, and they were on the Earth to eventually be harvested. So the last third of the movie, I admit, I think I weeped a little bit by the end, because these are people, but they're eventually going to die because they're going to be harvested. Organ harvesting, yeah, for life extension. Yeah, so this is a near future movie, not science, you know, nothing like Star Wars. This is near future we're talking. So
Star Wars is a long time ago. Right?
What?
No, Star Wars was a long time ago.
Well, I say that's right. Long time ago in a galaxy far away.
Okay, so this would be the question over here. The question would be, how would Judaism view something, you know, as jaw dropping as having these nice people, these teenagers in school, and suddenly you realize that they're there to extend the life of others. One can certainly conceive in countries where there are, you have a totalitarian government where leading government members, for example, would want to live forever. Right. You can certainly conceive of something like that happening. Okay? A la Boys from Brazil type of scenario. So the question that it boils down to is, would a clone be human? And if we define that a clone is human, then it has all the rights, and we would have all the obligations that we would have to any other human we would have towards this clone. If we decide that a clone is not a human, then A, we would have to decide what is it, and however we define it, we would have to give it accordingly the rights or the responsibilities. Just as an example, animals, as I've discussed, I think a year or two ago, we had a class about animal rights. Animals do not have rights in Judaism, but humans have responsibilities, okay, towards those animals, not to treat them inhumanely if not necessary. And we discuss then what's called a necessity, what's not. That's not our discussion today. So if a clone is a human, it has all the rights of a human. We would have all the responsibilities towards them that we have towards any other human. But if it's not a human, then you'd have to decide, would it have the status of an animal, perhaps? Then perhaps you have to treat it the same way you would an animal. Perhaps it's less than an animal, then you wouldn't even have those obligations. So that's really the question, is would you define it as a human? And as I said, you're not going to find this question in classic rabbinic literature because it hasn't happened yet. But we do find a similar, somewhat similar, slightly similar situation with, those who were here last month, I brought this up last month already, the idea of a golem. Okay, the golem is most famous from the famed Maharal of Prague. Some of you may have read the stories, the books about the supposed, there is a great deal of controversy whether the Maharal ever made a golem or not, a humanoid figure. But there is an idea in Jewish literature of a golem, and in fact, there's a passage in the Talmud that talks about it, that's source number two. And the Talmud says that Rava created a person, a humanoid really, what it should be, and sent it to his colleague, Rabbi Zera. Rabbi Zera spoke to it. It did not reply because it couldn't talk. More about that shortly. And he said to it, "You are a creation of my colleagues. Return to your dust." And that's what happened. This humanoid figure, Rava, created out of earth, out of dust, and when he told it this, it returned to its dust. And there are other recorded incidents of humanoid figures being created by people through Jewish mystical means and so on. Okay, Rabbi Schwab, I don't know if we could have a course about how to do that one day, maybe. Practical Kabbalah. All right, we'll make the spoons float, you know.
Huh? That a golem?
Oh, the golem. How to make a golem. All right. How to make a golem. I don't know, I think there are no shortage of golems running around today already. But, so that is the patch of the Talmud. Now, just left by itself, it would seem that Rav Zera had no problem disposing of this humanoid figure. He just said, "Well, you're not real, you're just a creation of my colleagues, so return to your dust." Well, does that mean that if I create a being that looks human, that walks around human, and so on, then I can do whatever I please with it? I don't like it, I can just get rid of it? Is that the implication? So source number three sheds some more light on it. The Maharsha, Rabbi Shmuel Edels, lived in the 1500s in Poland. He comments on this, that this was not a human, but rather just a humanoid figure. And he says the power of the soul, which is the power of speech, he was unable to create. Okay? This is a basic Jewish idea that the power of speech, and by speech I don't mean, you know, a bird tittering in the tree or a lie, you know, animals communicating, but what you might call more complicated speech, expression of self and so on, which is unique to humans. Someone might say that there are great apes that have those capabilities as well. Perhaps, I'm not going to get into that right now, but let's just, to keep things simple for now, assume that the power of complex speech is unique to humans, and that is the power that of this spiritual soul that God has invested in us. Now, what is that soul about? So the Maharshal says that because he did not possess a soul, what's a soul? What's called in Hebrew a neshama, which is the spirit that ascends upward. Okay, that is the part of ourselves, the spiritual side of ourselves that God invests us with. That is what's called the soul, the neshama. Okay? A human cannot create that. That is, as is expressed, in a sense, a part of God Himself that He placed within us as humans that gives us our spiritual side as well as the power of self-expression and speech. Okay? He says, but only the power of life, that's what He was able to put in, and that an animal also possesses. And therefore, He said, we'll return to your dust. So the Maharsha tells us that this humanoid creature was invested with the power of life that an animal would have, but not with the spiritual soul, if you will, that comes from God, that heavenly spiritual side of ourselves, and therefore it was not human, and therefore there was not an issue to dispose of it. Okay? That is what the Maharsha supposes. And to take it a step further, in source number four, the Chacham Tzvi, Rabbi Tzvi Ashkenazi, a 17th century rabbi, said that if you think it has a purpose, this golem, insofar as it can combine to be part of a minion of 10 people, okay, this is the question that was raised. He actually discusses, this rabbi, he says that his grandfather made a golem. And the question was raised, would the golem that his grandfather made be able to be part of a minion? As I mentioned last month, that would be very convenient if you only have 9 people today in shul, in the synagogue. No problem, we've got the golem over here. We've got our minion. Makes life a lot easier. No phone calls, no pulling people out of bed early in the morning. And that's it. So he says, if you think this thing, this humanoid, can combine for a minion, Rabbi Zeir would not have removed it from the world. For though there is no prohibition of murder, for a fetus formed in the mother's womb would engender liability of murder. So Rabbi Ashkenazi, the Chacham Tzvi, defines for us that murder is only an issue for a human. And a human, he says, is defined as that which is born, a fetus developed as an embryo within the mother's womb and then born. But this thing, this humanoid, was not born of a mother, and therefore there's no issue of murder. And he also concludes that it cannot combine for a minion either. Now, so he seems to take the approach that a golem, there's no prohibition of murder, it's not considered a human, you can basically do what you want with it, because it's not human. But that's a golem. Why is it a golem? It's not born of a mother. But let's take this whole discussion now, let's go back to clones. And let's assume what?
You just tell when the Chacham Tzvi lived.
I mentioned he lived during the 1600s.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I wasn't there.
Okay, that's fine. Yeah.
As always,
I believe
we were way ahead in technology. So.
Yes, as Mark points out, some of you may have heard the joke. You talk about the Jews being ahead of the game in the technology. That they in England, they had a news report that they dug some 100 feet down and they found telephone wires. And based on the dating in the strata, they said, oh, in England we had telephone wires 500 years ago. So France, not to be outdone, digs and digs and digs. They go down 200 feet and they find telephone wires. They said, you see, in France we already had telephone wires 1,000 years ago. So the Israelis start digging and excavating and digging and digging, and they don't find anything. He said, we had cell phones. Okay, so now I can use that joke at least for 6 months again. All right. So, but that's the issue. It's not a human, but a clone. Let's suppose a clone. And I don't think Mark mentioned this, but my understanding of how right now the the technology of a clone works is that they take the ovum of the egg of a woman, and they remove the genetic material from inside, and they implant, not a woman, let's say a female sheep, if you're making Dolly, and they take the genetic material from the cell of the we'll call parent animal, and they implant it inside, and then it develops like a normal embryo, but it's implanted within a mother's womb, within the animal's womb, and it develops over there. Okay, so essentially then, if the criteria for a human, as he says, is a fetus formed in the mother's womb, well then a clone developed that way would fit the criteria of a human. The question would become, that's how they're doing it now. What if they, as you said, they start having machines where you can create a baby in a test tube? I don't know.
Or like I said, if you take, all you got is, you take someone's hair and you can get those cells to reproduce into a fetus and then implant that.
Right. Yeah. Well, again, if it's in the mother, then seemingly it would be considered a human.
Right.
Okay?
But yes, there is an idea you could just do it in a machine and skip the...
And skip the whole thing. So then it would not seemingly...
Mm-hmm. There was a book, a lot of us have read Brave New World. Remember that book that was written in the 50s?
Right. Well, yeah, old text.
Uh-huh. I didn't read it.
But yeah, the people were all raised in machines.
That's right. Yeah. So seemingly that it would not fit the criteria of a human. But we're not done yet. Source number 5 and 6. There's a Mishnah in Tractate Bechoros that says, that which comes out of an impure animal is impure, that which comes out of a pure animal is pure. Now, this is a totally separate discussion where the Talmud talks about the following case. What if you have an animal with the kosher signs, split hooves and chews its cud, born of a non-kosher animal? Okay, so let's say a donkey gives birth to an animal that looks like a calf, a cow calf, or let's say a cow gives birth to an animal that looks like a baby donkey. Would the animal be kosher or not? So the Talmud says if it was born from a kosher animal, it's kosher, and if it's born from a non-kosher animal, it is non-kosher. Now that's for kosher purposes. Okay, and by the way, it applies also to other products. Milk, for example. Milk coming out of a non-kosher animal, because it emerges from a non-kosher animal, is non-kosher. Milk coming from a kosher animal, because it emerges from a kosher animal, is kosher. There are authorities that say, I quoted here, the Chazon Ish, whom I mentioned at the outset. He says, all those who are born, their lineage and laws go after those who bore them. And seemingly, he's basing this, and others base this idea on this Mishnah. Because the Mishnah tells us that which comes out from kosher is kosher, and that which comes out from non-kosher is non-kosher, you can broaden that idea to mean that that which emerges from a creature has the same status as the parent. And so based on that, if a human is created, a clone is created, and it comes, where did it come from? It came from another human. So if I go ahead and I make a clone of myself, and I took cells from a hair follicle inside my cheek, whatever it may be, and I created a human. Well, where did it emerge from? It came from the inside of my cheek. It's coming from me. I'm a human. Some might disagree with that, but I'm a human, and therefore, what comes out of me will be human as well. So the argument would go. Okay. And again, there's a very broad discussion about this, but a lot of authorities would seemingly agree, the consensus from what I saw seems to be, that because a clone would emerge from a human, it has the status, it's coming from a human, the cell is coming from a human originally, it would be considered a human as well. And once you establish the identity as a human, no harvesting organs, even if the clone, let's say, could survive. Let's say a person needs a kidney. Okay, you can't make a clone of yourself to harvest a kidney, because you can't just take someone else's kidney, unless they agree. If they want to donate a kidney, that's very nice of them. But you can't force someone to donate a kidney to save someone else's life. And so once it's a human, that human is entitled to all the rights, and you have all the responsibilities. You can't enslave that human any more than you can enslave your own child, because your child is not your property, it's another human. And so you can't enslave your child, you can't enslave your clone either, because it's another human being. And once you establish identity as a human being, it will have all those rights. You cannot kill it, you cannot beat it up, you can't use it as a punching bag, anything else that you were imagining, sorry, you'll have to find some other way to do that. But, as Marx said, what about cloning a liver or a heart? Well, a liver or a heart, I don't think would be considered a human. It's an organ. And so once we assume that a liver or a heart are not considered a human, I don't know that we would have a problem with that. I don't even think there would necessarily be an issue with source number one of playing God too much if you're cloning an organ, because again, this is just my opinion for whatever it's worth. If you're talking about creating humans through unnatural processes, instead of the union of a male and a female creating a child, if you're talking about producing a heart or a liver, that's not something where you say, God put a natural process into place of creating a heart or a liver. There is no natural process of creating hearts and livers in the world that you could say you're messing around with the order of creation and playing God. A person needs a kidney or a heart, so then I would venture to say perhaps you wouldn't even have a problem of playing God too much, because you're not changing the natural order of how God set things up, really. You're not creating new things. You're not creating a new creation. You're not finding a new way to reproduce. A person needs a liver. You could recreate a liver.
And it's for medical purposes akin to stem cell.
Stem cell research, correct. A lot of the stem cell questions would touch on these issues as well, right? And maybe we need a separate class on the stem cell issue, because a lot of the stem cell controversy is that often the stem cells are taken from once you already have a fertilized cell.
Right.
And the question is, when does life start? And all those issues that come into play, that's where a lot of the stem cell issues come into play.
Rabbi, you said that there's a prohibition on bringing a child into the world through not the physical process.
I didn't say a prohibition. I said some say it would not be in the spirit of the law.
All right, so it's not in the spirit. But isn't the onus of that on the parents? But the status of the child would certainly be as you just described. It'd be a human child.
Yeah, if one went ahead and did it, this child would be a child. Yes, absolutely. It would be a human. Perhaps some authorities may say it should not be done in the first place, but after the fact, it would be considered a human being.
Huh?
Let me just add, right, you are correct. So for example, a mule is the product of a horse, a union of a horse and a donkey. So a Jew cannot crossbreed a horse and a mule. But if you are a Jewish farmer, can you get a mule? Are you allowed to purchase one? So, yes, you are allowed to utilize a mule. Are you allowed to eat clementines? I'm assuming that they are a product of crossbreeding. Or the myriad other crossbred fruits, the pluots that are cross plum and apricots and stuff like that. Are you allowed to eat those? Yes, you are allowed to. Once it's there, you're allowed to utilize it. You're not supposed to be creating it in the first place. But once it's already created, you can benefit from them. All right?
What about GMOs?
I think we're going to do another session on that.
Yeah. No, so GMOs, yeah. The first source would be a major source of the question of GMOs. GMOs would be, first of all, the spirit of the law, okay? And also, there we get more technical in terms of, because there you are, in a sense, cross-breeding. You're taking genes from one thing, putting it into another. You run into a lot of other issues. If I take pig genes, put them into a tomato, does a tomato now become not kosher because it's got pig genes inside of it? And I believe that they've done this. They've put pig genes, I think, inside tomatoes to make them more, I think, frost-hardy or something like that.
I know they put spider genes into, like, corn to make the corn resistant to diseases. I've heard that, too, yeah.
Okay, I'm going to make a real bad joke and say that corn has a leg up.
Yeah.
All right. So. Sorry.
But that's a great subject.
Yeah.
It could be a whole other class.
Rather than get back, I just like you to, I want to run out of time, but I don't know how we're doing, but 7 and 8, I think, are really important, and it kind of goes back to what we're talking about. There's another science fiction book that just came out. It was actually, it was featured in Time magazine. I thought I was the only one that thought it was brilliant. But then I picked up a Time, and it was a big picture of the author, and it's called Seven Eves, and it's epic about how there's a disaster on Earth and everybody has to leave. Turns out there's seven women that end up surviving this whole thing and making a home on an asteroid. And it goes forward from there. It's a 5,000-year book. But they decide, they have some genetic material that they brought up, that there's absolutely no problem in making children. There's no more males.
Right. So for the purpose of preservation of the species,
yeah.
And what it is that they have to...
another aspect, but I think it's important, you know,
if it takes a mother and a father and the soul of Hashem to make a person, I think that's really an interesting point in Judaism.
Right.
That could, you know, because eventually there's going to be the soul of the will of God, but just a mother can make a baby.
Right.
I mean, I don't think you're going to need...
We're moving in that direction. Right. Correct.
Forever.
And there'd be women who probably might choose, well, I don't want to carry three kids. If I could grow my kids in the machine, yeah. Right?
I want to have a baby. Why do I need to pick a sperm donor? I don't need that anymore. I'll just have a baby.
Or if she really likes herself, she wants to have another. Some people wouldn't want that, but you know.
A clone, but it's an interesting concept if you cut the men out of the whole equation.
So let's try to talk about that a little bit. And again, I don't know that we'll have a hard and fast answer, but just some of the ideas that come up, and we'll move on with that.
And then it brings, you know, it'll be true that women need a man like a fish needs a bicycle.
That will have to be a different class. Yeah. Yes.
Sorry.
Well, the GMO fish can ride the bicycle.
Okay. So that brings us, as you point out, Saul, to source number 7. There are three partners in the formation of a person. This is a passage in the Talmud in Kiddushin. There are three partners in the formation of a person: God, the father, and the mother. And the Talmud talks about which aspects the father contributes, which aspects the mother contributes. I'm not getting involved in that now, that part of the Talmud, although it is worthwhile to note that scientifically speaking, without getting involved in the passage of the Talmud itself, there are certain things which only the mother contributes. For example, the mitochondrial the genes needed for the mitochondria come exclusively from the mother, not from the father. There is something I believe today called mitochondrial therapy. If there's a defect in the mitochondria, where they can, and I think they may already be doing this, where they can adjust or change the mitochondrial DNA. To take away the defect. Okay, so you already have genetic manipulation going on, if not cloning, when they know there's a defect in the genes of the mother, and the mother is the exclusive contributor of the mitochondria. So, but the Talmud says that God places within him the spirit of life, the soul. Okay, and the Sefer HaChinuch, which is a medieval work whose authorship is unknown, comments that it is God's desire that the world be settled by good creations born from a male and female who unite in the proper way. Okay? That's the point he makes over there, that's how God created the world, for that process to take place. That is how God wants the world to run. So even if we'll say that one can clone a copy of oneself, but you have this idea in the Talmud that you have a couple, a male and female, coming together in order to be able to create a child. And that is God's intent in the world, so you would have then the ethical issue, perhaps, of cloning. It might be scientifically possible, might be convenient for a lot of people, but bottom line is that's not God's desire in creation. Another issue, which I will tell you Rabbi Schwab was kind of badgering me on, was would a child, a clone, necessarily have a soul given by God? No, it's when this passage says there are three partners, the mother, the father, and God himself, does that preclude that if you're missing the father or the mother, then God stays out of the picture as well, and the offspring wouldn't necessarily have a soul? Because as we saw earlier, it's possible for a human to create a being with the force of life, much like an animal. Okay, as we discussed before, the idea of a golem. But the spiritual soul, that which the Maharsha tells us, that part of us that comes from a higher source, okay, that comes from God himself, would that necessarily be invested in a human-like being created from another human if there is not, you don't have a mother and a father involved? I don't know the answer. I guess we'll have to wait and see. Or at whatever point it happens. It's possible that it would. It's possible the Talmud is just saying this is the natural order of things, but it could function without that. It's possible the Talmud is saying it's a necessity. You need a mother and a father in order for God to put the soul in there as well. Absent one of those two, then the child wouldn't necessarily have a soul. Then you raise another question. I'm just going to throw this out there. Again, nothing definitive, but just to set your head spinning a little bit. If we define a human as being born of another human, if that human is lacking a soul, is it lacking the basic essence of humanity and therefore would lose the status of human, despite the fact that it is a creature born of another human? One can make that argument perhaps as well. I don't know. You don't think so. Okay, we have to see, right? But so, you know, if my fingernails, just because it comes from me, is not a full-fledged human, so would one argue that a being born of another human, but lacking the divine soul, perhaps would lack that basic definition of being a human?
Why wouldn't the soul be carried in the cells that are used to germinate? There was a mother.
Okay,
father.
Because
who created?
Because who says the soul? Because the soul is not necessarily carried in the cells. There's an entire Talmudic discussion about at what point does God invest an embryo with a soul. There was a discussion between Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, the writer of the Mishnah, and Antoninus. There's some question exactly which Roman emperor he was. One of the Roman emperors with whom he had a very friendly relationship. About at what point God puts the soul into the baby. So there's a whole discussion about that, which means that even in the embryo, the soul, the baby is waiting there to receive a soul from God. It's not automatic that just because a mother and a father created a child inside the womb of a mother, that there's a soul automatically. God has to put it there. And if God says, well, I'm lacking the other two partners, so I'm not putting in my part either, that would be the question.
Well, why are we defining partners by the fact that there's what we call a mother and father, and that's a self from a mother and a self from a father.
Okay, so I'm going to try to get to that now. If it's a self from a mother and a self from a father, the argument is a little bit easier. What if it's only a self from one and not from the other?
Is that possible?
Yeah, on the contrary, what cloning has done now, correct me if I'm wrong, is just one person. It'll eventually happen. You'll be able to clone from two.
Yeah, I mean, the whole idea of cloning is you're making the most... You know, definitive definition of cloning is you're making an exact copy of somebody. You're not taking cells from this. I mean, I guess in a sense you could clone two people and merge. You merge them together. Now you've got an offspring of two people as a
super athlete, super athlete, super genius.
Yeah. But it's not exactly a clone at that point. It's something else.
Right. I mean, then the question would be what would be. So now I'll use. So I'll use Rabbi Haman's question as a segue to get into the last part. And this is probably the most head-spinning part, and we don't have that much time, but I just want to touch on some of the questions that would come up in a few Talmudic sources. Okay? The question over here is, if I go ahead and I have a clone of myself, so what is the status of that clone vis-a-vis me? Is it my child? Does the child have the obligations towards me of a parent? There's a mitzvah in the Torah to honor your father and your mother. Does he have to honor me? There's a prohibition against wounding, a specific prohibition with a pretty heavy penalty against wounding or cursing a parent. Okay, you shouldn't wound or curse anybody. But there's a heavier penalty for wounding or cursing a parent specifically. Would that apply? Would there be an issue of incestuous relationships according to halacha? I'm not getting involved in the genetic side of it if you talk about inbreeding. But would there be an issue of incestuous according to halacha? Would that be a father and a child? A mother, if the child is female, would they, according to halacha, I'm not saying it would go over well in the media, would they be allowed to marry each other theoretically? Okay, and so on. Would that be permitted? That is the question. There are two points we have to look at. Number one, what is the definition of a father? And number two, what's the definition of a mother? And when you have those definitions, you can try and figure out whether a clone, vis-a-vis the provider of the genetic material, would be considered a parent-child, perhaps a sibling. Would it be considered a sibling, perhaps, and so on. So, a couple sources. Just a couple sources. There are, again, this is a huge, huge discussion, and as you'll see in a moment, it has practical ramifications even today, as you'll see in a second. But just two sources, then we'll see where it takes us. There is a passage in the Talmud that says the following. The passage in the Talmud says that the two of Yaakov's, of Jacob's wives, Leah and Rachel, Leah had a bunch of sons, six of them to be exact, and Rachel, for a while, did not have any. Okay, and then Rachel bore Joseph, and Leah was expecting again a seventh child. And prophetically, they knew that there would only be 12 tribes. And already 11 of the 12 had been born, because the maidservants had, the two other wives had provided four of those children. There were 11 total. And so Leah's expecting a child, and Rachel's expecting a child. And Leah prophetically knew that her child was going to be a boy, number 12. And she said to herself, if I have another boy, then my sister Rachel will only have one child. The other wives who were more secondary status, not my discussion right now why that's so, more secondary status, had two each. So Rachel would have less children, members of the tribes, than the two other secondary wives. And so Leah prayed to God that the gender of her child be switched in the womb. And that's what occurred. And the gender was switched to a female, and hence she had a daughter, Dinah. Okay, if you look in the Torah, you'll see Dinah got into trouble later because she was kidnapped and assaulted and so on. So she figures prominently in several passages in the Torah. She got changed to a girl. The simple understanding of the passage is that the gender was switched miraculously. The Talmud says that normally you can't, once 40 days after conception have elapsed, when the embryo, when the actual body starts to form, prayer can no longer switch the gender because it's already has begun to physically develop. Miraculously, her prayers effected that change. Okay. In fact, the Targum Yonasan, who is a Mishnah, one of the sages of the Mishnah, understands that in fact what happened was that Leah was expecting a child, Rachel was expecting a child, Rachel had a girl in her womb, Leah had a boy in her womb, and they got switched. Not that the gender switched, the babies miraculously got switched with each other. Don't ask me how that happened, I have no idea. Miracles like this happen in the Torah all the time. And so they got switched, and so Leah's boy went to Rachel's womb and was born as Benjamin. I'm sorry, as Joseph. And the girl went from Rachel over to Leah and was born as Dinah. Okay, I mentioned earlier Joseph hadn't been born already, I make a mistake. This was Joseph's birth. So in a sense, then, Rachel gave birth to a child conceived by her sister, Leah. Leah gave birth to a girl conceived by her sister, Rachel. So you would think that, in fact, Leah is the mother of Joseph, and Rachel is the mother of Dinah. But the Torah makes it very clear to us that, in fact, who is Joseph's mother? Rachel. And who is Dinah's mother? Leah. And this would be a source, there are other proofs as well to this, and many authorities take this approach, that the mother is not defined as the one who conceives the child, but the mother is defined as the one who gives birth to the child. Okay? This gets into a whole discussion about surrogate motherhood. Who is the mother? That's not today's discussion, but that is where it's applicable today's day and age, even that's without cloning.
Huh? Next month, right?
Well, yeah, somewhere. We'll talk about it. Okay, but that is, so now, if we define a mother as one who gives birth to the child, then a simple clone, if a woman, let's just say, provides genetic material for a clone, and the clone is implanted in another woman, she wouldn't be, the one who provided the genetic material would not be the mother. The mother would be the one who carried the child, who gave birth to the child, is what would come out. According, again, it's a huge, complicated discussion. There are authorities that say that, in fact, we are stringent and treat both as mothers wherever, because we're not sure. Is the mother the one who provided the conception, or the mother was the one who gave birth? So there are authorities, a great authority, Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach, a great halachic authority, passed away at the end of the 20th century, is quoted as having said that one must be stringent and treat both as mothers. Okay? That's so that's a lot of nagging, potentially down the line. But that is, so therefore potentially one could, a clone wouldn't necessarily be considered a mother, or potentially would be considered a mother, depending on which way you go. Is the mother the one who gives birth to the child, or is the mother the one who conceives the child? Even if you'll say it's the one who conceives the child, perhaps that's only due to the conception, not to the fact that she provides the genetic material. And so a clone where she never conceived the child herself wouldn't be a mother according to either side of the question. So you see where things get a little dicey over here. Bottom line is just stay away from the whole cloning thing. The last question is define a father. Define a father. And this is also a huge Halacha question today, when you talk about issues of IVF and so on, where there a child can be created within a womb, but without the normal procedure of a male and female having a regular natural union together to create a child, but where the father provides the sperm to create a child inside the womb, it's implanted inside the womb, but it's not necessarily through the natural means. Is that individual considered a halachic father or not? You can see in source number 10, the way it's expressed is that a woman becomes pregnant through where it came through external matter, not directly through the union of a male and female. There's a question of whether the father, A, would fulfill his obligation. There's an obligation in the Torah of procreation. And B, would he be called the father for all purposes? Okay. The consensus of many authorities, not all, is that whoever the father is, doesn't matter how it got into the womb, the provider is considered the halachic father. And again, a huge, huge discussion, not for now, but for our discussion of the clone, would become the following question. Is providing a cell, just a cell, is that the same thing or not? Is that the same thing or not? Does it have to be specifically through the normal means of providing his half of the genetic material that he's called the father? Or if he takes a hair follicle and does it that way, is he considered the father as well? That's another, so that would be another question that would have to be dealt with. Okay.
Any questions?
Thank you. Any questions from anybody?
Lots.
All right. Save it for next time, and thank you all for coming.
We got 5 minutes. Any questions? Everyone's just too stunned and blown away to even speak.
And I was thinking, as you're saying, if the genes came, the genetic material came from one person, is that the mother? And the one who, if it was in the womb, is that the mother? But what if it's a machine? Do we call the machine mommy? Or?
Yeah. Probably not. It's not human, right? So the obligation wouldn't be there. Another question that would come up is, can a woman be called a father if she's providing genetic material, but not as the female side, but in the sense of the male side, just providing the genetic material, but not carrying the child? Would the woman then theoretically be considered a father, not a mother? So all these different types of questions would have to be dealt with.
Yeah. Are there laws of adoption that would solve many of these issues? I mean, if you adopt a child, isn't that child considered your child?
Not in terms of the Torah obligations.
So it's a stranger.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. In fact, there's a Talmud in the passage that says that straight out, that there was a grandfather who raised his grandchild. And then one day the grandfather asked the grandchild, can you get me a glass of water? And he said, no, you're not my father, I don't have to listen to you. That's the Talmudic passage. And the Talmud says, based on that people say, raise me, provide for me, but you're not my father.
So the heightened halacha of honoring the parent does not exist.
Only the biological parents. Mm-hmm. Again, the halachic, however you would define parents, would be that, yeah. not the adoptive parent.
Right, person. And we really didn't even touch today, because we talked about it when we met, the whole idea of if it's a sterile couple. And you know, this is like, do they go out and adopt versus going out and creating a child through a clone? You know, and again, it's...
Right, and there would become a more emotional question that you would have to deal with it.
Then, right, right.
And so on, yeah. So yeah. Definitely these were the issues that have to be dealt with.
Mark's movie, where you've got these clones growing up, acting like humans, do they have souls?
Well, in that movie, they convinced you that they had souls.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Right. Yeah. I have to believe
that would be the intuitive thought.
Yeah. Right.
But
the rabbi made a point that, what did you say? If they can be created or something, technically they're not people.
If a human creates a humanoid,
right.
So he can. So apparently from the Talmud, it's possible to imbue that creature with life force, but not with a spiritual soul.
So then it would be okay to have a...
So that would be the question that I mentioned, that if it's a creature born of a mother, does that make it human despite the lack of a soul? Or is a soul an intrinsic part of the definition of humanness? That would be a question that would have to be dealt with.
There seems to be a loophole in Judaism that would allow this sort of...
It's okay to create a golem?
It's not that clear that it's okay to create a golem either, but yeah.
Because yes. You're bringing up some pretty deep mystical powers there, aren't you?
There's a lot of science fiction out
forces, I should say.
To about people creating something like a duplicate. And, you know, that person is there for you if you need a heart, a kidney.
Right, so that's what Mark mentioned in that in this movie. Mm-hmm. Again, once you define it as a human, that's all out the window.
And that probably, you know, so it's theoretical, but we know, again, the next few years, someone's either going to say, I can clone someone, or they're going to do it. And then there are going to be people, like let's say we have an amoral nation where the leaders are don't have any, you know, morality, and they're like, wow, we can live for 200 years.
Cause I
we
think
just,
so much of it depends on if there is a neshama. We don't know yet if there will be a neshama.
And what would a soulless human, let's say a clone comes out of the womb and it doesn't have a soul, what's that going to look like?
You could have a life force.
There's different levels
right.
of the shaman.
An animal, on the contrary, your first source is really the starting point of it all, because the whole concept of not mixing genders, not this
species.
Sorry.
Freudian slip over there.
This is species is because we want to keep things under the proper context, the proper level.
Dollars.
So the proper context of things, the proper level of things, means that you can still create something that looks like
it
has life, but not
has
a soul.
Right. That's, you know, we don't know what's going to... You're not going to know until it happens.
That's the same, too.
Okay. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.